Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Allan Gray podcast. My name is Duncan Artis. I'm the Chief Investment Officer at Allan Gray. As you know, we've been trying to grow the podcast as a medium to have more meaningful discussions with our clients. Most of the time, it'll be representatives of Orbis or Allan Gray speaking on the podcast, but we're always on the lookout for interesting outside people who can give their insights. We're also quite aware, as me as a Capetonian, that traffic is getting much worse. And so hopefully this is something you can put in and listen while you're stuck in the traffic. Today, we are fortunate enough to have David McWilliams, author, economist, Irishman, and podcaster. And we look forward to having a great discussion with him. So David, maybe we could start, if you just give us a little bit of background, how you got to where you were. And most importantly, do you support Irish Rugby Union?
Okay, so on the rugby union, you have a gentleman who plays 10 for you called Lebock, okay? And we would really, if you could answer up the prayer for the Irish nation, play that man every time he plays us. Give him every spot kicking opportunity, give him penalties, give him conversions. It's a thing of beauty to see a Springbok 10 who can't kick. And I don't know if Manny Lebock has actually improved, but every time we play you, we just think, okay, who's 10? If it's Pollard, oh no, they'll do the usual thing. You know, eight big monsters pushing us around the place, giving us opportunities to give away penalties, and then Pollard hits us from all over the pick. But Lebock, I mean, all day, he can run like a gazelle, but he can't kick. It's actually funny, I was watching Orgy Snyman is now playing for Leinster, who is a beast of the highest caliber. So we don't make creatures that big in Ireland. So we'll import you guys.
Give us a little bit of background.
Okay.
How you got to where you were. Trinity College, how you came to the Kilconomics, which you're more famous for.
I suppose I have been trying to avoid a real job for most of my life. That's probably the bottom line. No, I studied economics at Trinity College. I now teach economics at Trinity College. So there's a certain lovely symmetry in terms of the career. I then went and did a master's in Belgium. I then came back. I worked in our central bank at the time when Chris Stiles was the boss man at the Central Bank of South Africa. I was working as a junior, like a young economist. And then I moved from the central bank, which was great because it gives you a really, really good grounding in monetary economics, in exchange rates, rates of interest, basically how the game works from the inside. I then moved to UBS, large Swiss bank in London. I spent many years there. I then went to BNP Paribas. And then, you know, I got one of those epiphanies. I have a little Vespa and I was driving my Vespa through London about 6:15 one morning. And I said to myself, I'm not sure I want to be working for a guy for the rest of my life. Even if, as you know, working in investment banking, it's hardly working. You just have to get up early. But I did end up being the head of emerging markets in BNP. So that's how it led me to South Africa and all sorts of places like that. And I decided to come home to Ireland and start a new career doing television, doing documentaries, doing journalism, writing books, all sorts of things. And then Kilconomics, which is the world's only economics and stand-up comedy festival, which you guys have to come to, you simply have to come to, came because I was doing a one-man show in our national theatre, the Abbey Theatre. And a friend of mine, who is a comedian, said, look, David, there's something about standing on stage and talking about economics and you know, that's what we do. You know, comedians were up there trying to explain the world in our own bizarre way. And we had a couple of drinks and then a couple more drinks and then far too many drinks. And by the end of that evening, Kilconomics was born. I said, I'll bring the economists, you bring the comedians. And away we go. You might know if you've ever seen the Irish comedy or British comedy, Father Ted. I don't know if you've ever seen it. So the character was Father Dougal was the geezer who gave me this notion. And I said, look, I'll bring economists. But what I've been trying to do in a nutshell, all my career, Duncan, is try to make economics more comprehensible, more understandable, and more relevant to people's everyday lives. I think when I started, I realized that economics was owned by almost what I would call a clerisy, almost like clerics, high priests, who are good at maths, who were good at stats.
The Chicago School of Economics.
Yeah, and I thought, you know what? This isn't the economics that my mother understands. It's not the economics that my mates understand. It's not the world they live in. And so since I left banking, which is now 20-odd years ago, I have spent most of my working time trying to deliver economics in a different way to wider audiences, be it podcasting, be it social media, be it TV, be it radio. Yeah, I've even done it through cartoons. And of course, Kilconomics through comedy is probably the most unusual example of that.
So David, maybe if we can move to the book, Money, A Story of Humanity. And to everyone who's listening, I can highly recommend it. I've read a lot of books about markets and economic history. I really enjoyed the way you framed it. Maybe you could just tell us why you wrote it. What was your thinking about putting money together as the greatest human invention with innovation throughout all of history? And the one thing that struck me at the beginning was your quote, most economists don't understand money.
Yes.
Which is a bit disappointing after they paid for their degree.
You're absolutely right. The book is called Money, A Story of Humanity. It is been published by Simon & Schuster in South Africa. And I'm going down to Franschhoek for the Literary Festival in May. So I'm really looking forward to it. No, the basic idea of the book came from my eureka moment, having worked in central banking, having worked in academia, having worked in investment banking, having worked in emerging markets and investment banking, and having been an economist for 30-odd years, I had this bizarre revelation that having listened to economics or economists talk about money, that they don't understand it, that economists don't understand money, which is always why I've always, have you ever met a rich economist?
Nope.
No, they're terrible at money. They don't understand it. So what I tried to see, I was thinking, the way economists think about money is not only wrong, it's adolescent, okay? And your average plumber has a much better understanding of what money does to us. So what I'm much more interested, I mean, an economist can tell you, speaking of plumbers, so an economist can tell you, like a plumber, the way in which, for example, if you ask a plumber, you say, you know, how does the water go around the house? Plumber will say, oh, it goes in this pipe and that pipe and this pipe leads to that pipe and if the water pressure is right, you'll get good pressure in your shower, yada, yada, yada. But if you ask that plumber, why do we need water for life? They may well be hard-pressed to give you an answer. So they can explain to you the mechanisms by which water gets around the house, but you say, well, what is the molecular, scientific, biological requirement for life and water, etc., etc.? They have no idea, right? Economists are the same. They can tell you how much water goes around the system, say, oh, inflation's going up or the interest rate's going down or the rate of exchange is this, that, and the other, and monetary policy should be this and money supply should be that. So they can tell you, like a plumber, how much water goes around the economy, the system. But if you ask an economist, what does money actually do? They are completely flummoxed. Why? Because the vast majority still have their communion money. They are not spenders or investors. They don't understand the magic of money. So the book is basically about the magic of money, about the relationship between humanity and money. And what struck me over the last 20 years is that the way to look at money is to understand that money is a technology. So when we think about technology, we usually think about physical technology, Duncan, like the plow or the internet or, for example, the steam engine. And we tell ourselves a story about human progression aided by technology. That's only half the story because that's physical technology. There is such a thing called social technology. And social technologies are the sort of technologies that make us work together more collaboratively. And money is, in my opinion, in the same way as language, money, like language, are social technologies that bring us together, allow us to understand each other, allow us to understand each other at much, much deeper levels. And that's what I looked at. I said, okay, if that's the idea, show me the evidence. And when you look at the start of money, it's about 5,000 years ago. In actual fact, like everything started in Africa. This is the amazing thing. About 20,000 years ago, there is evidence in Congo. The Belgians found a thing called the Ashango bone, which is a little small bone they found in the Congo basin, dated about 20,000 years ago. It's a little bone with tiny little notches taken out of it. And it is widely understood that this is the very first blockchain, ironically. This is the very first tally stick. It's a ledger of who owed what to whom. So Africans have been using money for a long, long time, the concept of counting, the concept of accounting. But when you see money coming in, that begins to look and feel like the way money is now, it's the Sumerian civilization 5,000 years ago. We kick off there. And what you see is this great relationship between innovations in money and innovations in what we would largely describe, Duncan, as human civilization, human progress, etc. So that's the key to the book. It goes from the Stone Age to Bitcoin, which is quite a, as you said, it's quite an expansive book. Yeah. It's peppered with stories, with individuals, with ideas, with notions.
Maybe tell the story about the printing press. It's one that really stuck in my head with Gutenberg. You told it a very different way.
The beautiful thing about Gutenberg is he was a total scoundrel, right? And he was a scoundrel. And the great thing about scoundrels is they tend to leave paper trails. So Gutenberg left a paper trail all around what is now West Germany or the western part of Germany because he was involved in fights and scraps. He defaulted on people. He defaulted on marriages. He broke his promise to marry certain women, etc., etc. But the main thing about Gutenberg is to understand that he wanted to make money. And he understood, or he copped on, that if he could figure out a way of printing, i.e. a way of writing, that he could duplicate at scale, he would be incredibly, incredibly popular with the main bank at the time, which was the Catholic Church. Now, why was this? Because the Catholic Church had probably the greatest monetary shakedown the world has ever seen, which was a thing called the selling of indulgences. And the selling of indulgences was a wonderful idea, which was, I will pay today to the church, let's say R1,000, in order to save the soul, not just of myself, but of my friends and my family, etc., etc. So the church could, I mean, as a way of making money, can you think of a better way to make money than avoiding hell? People were really afraid of hell. Really, really afraid of it. And Gutenberg came up with a great idea, which is you can pay to avoid it. Now, the reason he was important to the priests was Gutenberg could produce 800 times the amount of indulgences, which are effectively letters. So for the church, for Gutenberg to actually accelerate the production of the little pieces of paper, which were in effect the invoice that the church needed, this was a license to print money. Number one, he did that. Once he did that, he figured out, hold on a second, the bigger scam isn't the indulgences, which the average middle-of-the-road artisan pays. What about Bibles? Okay. And he said, if we can print Bibles, that's massive money spinner. Why? Because the Bibles were very expensive to print. And certainly they were incredibly expensive to have if you're describing or waiting for a monk with ink and a quill to write the whole thing. But really rich men paid the church for the pleasure of the copyright of writing Bibles. So he said, if we can get Bibles right, we can do it. Now, the beautiful thing about Gutenberg is that he was a designer by nature. He was very, very like Steve Jobs. He was a goldsmith. He was a designer. And what he said was, not only is the printing important, but what's really important is the look of the Bible. So Gutenberg's Bible, and I actually went to California 2 years ago to see one of the last real ones, which is an amazing, in the Smithsonian Museum in California. They are absolutely beautiful. And one of the great pieces, all entrepreneurs need a bit of luck, Duncan. You'll always, if you talk to entrepreneurs, they'll always say, I got a bit of luck there. The Pope at the time was a Pope called Pope Pius. He was the least pious man you've ever met, right? He was very vain and he was going blind. And what he hated doing because he was so vain was wearing glasses when he had to read the sermon in the Vatican. So he wanted somebody to create a Bible that he could read without his glasses. So people would see him in all his beauty at the age of, let's say, his late 40s. And Gutenberg's Bible was so well designed that the Pope got it and realized he could read it without using his glasses. And he said, this is the one. So Gutenberg got really lucky. He was dealing with a vain Pope and a good product. But the way to think about Gutenberg is to think about Steve Jobs, because what the Gutenberg Bible was like for the first time you saw it was like when people first saw the iPhone. It was not only incredibly informative, but it was absolutely beautiful. But this is the interesting part of the story. And this is where the relationship between the printing press and today's internet is very, very similar. What the printing press did in the same way as the internet has done is it democratized information. It created an entire background noise for change. By democratizing information, it meant more and more and more people could read, more and more and more people could listen to a new message. And in the same way as the internet has led to social media has led to Twitter, social media has led to Instagram. Think of that model, the dissemination of information. Exactly the same thing happened in the 15th and 16th century. The price of books collapsed because printing was much cheaper because you could print at scale, number one. And number two, people who understood the power of literacy came to the fore. Now, who was the main guy there? The main man who understood the power of literacy and the power of printing was one geezer called Martin Luther. Now, Martin Luther was the Twitter king, okay? If you understand people who are very good on Twitter and social media, Martin Luther was amazing. Why? Because he realized that people didn't want to read books. If you could create, in the same way as Twitter was originally 140 characters, if you could create something short and sharp that people could digest where the message was very, very clear, you could create a mass movement. And what he came up with was the pamphlet, which was a one-page printed, usually in bullet points, notion that would actually change the way in which people understood information. So the pamphlet was the major, major weapon of Protestantism. And when Luther figured this out, what he did was he used the printed word to undermine the Catholic Church all around Germany. As more and more people started to read, more and more people flocked to this new message, anti the church, and ironically, therefore, a technology that was supposed to bolster the original master, the church, became the technology that people use to usurp the church. Now, it's a very interesting analogy with the internet. The internet was started by the American deep state, the American government, American military. The idea was to bolster the power of the state. What has it done? The internet has, because the message has been disseminated, has undermined the power of the state, undermined the old elite. And as we can see now in the United States, has created this entire new elite, all of whom are publishers. Elon Musk is a publisher. Zuckerberg is a publisher. Bezos is a publisher. Think about it. All of them have been facilitated by the breakdown of the old order. And the new order has emerged because the message can no longer be controlled. If you look at exactly what happened in the Reformation, because Gutenberg reduced the stranglehold on literature and printing that the church had, it created an entire platform for an opposition. Martin Luther came up with the idea that the Catholic Church was corrupt, but he disseminated the idea through the pamphlet and the printing press. And as we know, that changed the world.
Speaking about the printing press, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but, you know, reading the book, sort of the critique of sort of the gold standard, it comes across you need money flexibility, your money supply needs to be able to grow. How do you think about that versus the inflations you spoke about with John Law, the US Civil War, the Weimar Republic, getting that sort of balance right between pure fiat paper money?
Yep.
Versus these things where it gets out of control.
Yep.
And you get sort of the vast sort of badly things that all those great inflations brought about.
Yeah, so excellent question, Duncan. So, I mean, again, this probably comes back, and you're probably the same as me. You're probably trained in monetary economics back in the day, and you've done all your bits and bobs. Like, I remember in the central bank realizing one thing is that the guys who were running the central bank really didn't have a great notion theoretically of what was going on, or practically. That was the first thing that kind of struck me as a young economist. But the second one, it's very simple, is the standard matters. So the gold standard, the monetary standard, what you use to benchmark valuation for paper money. So just to finish on the printing press, of course, the printing press led to paper money because you can't have paper money without printing. So very, very clear, it wasn't just it was a big change in ideology and religion and what have you. Obviously, it led to a form of money that the Dutch basically made, not so much perfect, but actually really made enormous efforts to understand paper money in the 16th century. So then it leads to what has paper money done? Paper money has been, I think, the most magical, one of the most magical inventions humans have ever come up with. But it needs to be policed. It needs to be managed. So you need to be able to, up the road from you in Zimbabwe, you had an affair where paper money became worthless, right? Why is that? It's very simple. Paper money needs to have a standard, needs to have an understanding on the part of the people that the state that is issuing the paper money will not debauch the currency excessively, right? That's the social contract that any government has with its people, which is we will look after the money, you look after your savings, okay? We will look after the money. And by that, I mean is we won't print too much of it. It's the kind of Goldilocks idea, not too hot, not too cold. We will continue expanding the money supply in response to the requirement of the economy for that money, because the economy always requires money, which is why the Bitcoiners and the gold bugs are kind of a bit stupid. You know, when it comes to actually understanding economics, they understand something else, but it's not economics or money. It's some other notion. We might come back to it in a second. But in order to do this, you need discretion. You need a certain amount of wisdom. You need a certain amount of political power, and which is why I say in the book is that what you really understand is that money is a public gun. Money is inherently as much part of the state as the army is, as the police force is, all that sort of stuff, right? So where you see episodes of debasing the currency profoundly, for example, was a large part of the book. The book opens with Hitler dropping pounds sterling out of planes over England to try and undermine the British war effort in the Second World War, all of which is true. This comes from his understanding of what happens when money dies, which is what happened in the Weimar Republic in Germany. So the thing about money, it is the most incendiary weapon a state has. And you manage it with great care, with great wisdom, and with great flexibility on the one hand, but a certain amount of alacrity and stability on the other, which is why central banking is hard, Duncan, which is why, you know, certain countries, again, I mentioned Zimbabwe, when you get this wrong, you get it really wrong. And why do you get it really wrong? Is it because economics goes out of control? No, not particularly. It's because we are a social animal, human beings. We are an unbelievably skitty creature. We are a creature that is driven by pessimism, by optimism. And when we begin to panic, we panic together. That's the key. So one of the key messages in the book is money is a social technology. And because it's a social technology, it is a crowd phenomenon. And in the same way as religion requires all of us to believe, money requires all of us to believe. And how do you undermine belief? You undermine the story. And the key story in money is the relationship between money and value. And value is this bizarre thing, Duncan, because it doesn't exist in real life. It's an entirely imagined notion. I value this. I think a pint of beer is worth this. I think a book is worth that. I think an internet subscription is worth this. Value is an example of a suspension of collective disbelief in humanity. And that's a bizarre thing. So you basically, you mess with money at your peril. So the book covers the psychology of money, the physical notion of money, the history of money. It superimposes economics on top of this. But in essence, Duncan, the book is about humanity and it's about us.
Interesting example is I was the banking analyst here for well over a decade. And I think 99 out of 100 people don't understand fractional reserve banking, but we'll leave that for another day. And just an example of why people find it hard. I was at a hotel in Sandton and there was all these NGOs, these young Americans about to go to Nigeria. And we run the world's biggest Africa fund and we couldn't find $10 million in Nigeria, but Janet Yellen was printing billions every day.
Yeah.
Why doesn't the Nigerian president just phone Janet Yellen and say, can't you move $100 million our way, please?
I think Sunny Abacha did that.
So there's no dollars in Nigeria.
Yeah.
But you're printing billions every day in developed markets and people can't get their heads around it.
Well, I suppose there's a variety of ways of getting your head around this. Like the first thing is that if you debase your currency profoundly, as has been the case in certain countries north of you, what you tend to create is this bizarre idea of the willingness to hoard. It's a thing called Gresham's Law in economics, which is that bad money, i.e. debased money, will eventually elbow out good money, which is, let's say, your dollars in this case. Okay? So what you have is a strange situation where the dollars in Nigeria are actually hoarded. There are plenty of dollars in Nigeria, but they're hoarded. Why? Because people know that the dollar will maintain its value. So it becomes a form of savings and it becomes a security point rather than something you spend. So you spend the money that you think is going to become worthless. Because at the end of the day, Duncan, the transaction is between the paper in your hand and let's say this glass of water, right? The glass that's in the water, right? If you believe that the paper in your hand is losing value against the glass, you'll try to get rid of it, okay? So that's the first thing. The second thing is this bizarre situation, which is the more capital controls you have, the less capital you will have. And how do you understand that, right? This always, when I worked for a Swiss bank years ago, UBS, an old Swiss banker, a boss of mine, I said to him, you know, how can people still continue to give money to Swiss banks? You know, why is this? I said, the secrecy? He said, yeah, it could be secrecy. But he said, the main reason, David, is we give it back to them. I said, what? He said, the main reason people give us their money is we give it back to them. And I couldn't get my head around that. He said, if you give money to a Swiss bank and you turn up tomorrow, you'll get it all back. He said, if you give money to a bank in a country with capital controls, you can't get it back. So what does that do? It changes the psychology you have towards the bank or the system, and you will tend typically to go elsewhere. Why? Because you understandably and logically conclude that they want your money and they're not prepared to actually give you money back. So there are a variety of things going on, but I would say the vast majority of developmental problems when it comes to monetary economics are psychological, not physical. And as long as you understand that, like, I'm from a country, Ireland, which we now laugh about, okay, because, you know, it's doing well, etc. But, you know, I was born in a very poor country that was full of controls, full of suspicion of the wealthy, full of suspicion of money moving in and out. It was a sort of a quasi-socialist worldview that if we can keep the money here, we'll use it. And you know what happened? We had a massive current account deficit, a huge amounts of capital flight. So I think that what you have to understand is money is a little bit like water. It travels the path of least resistance. And if you allow money to flow freely, it will flow into the areas where it's most physically beneficial to the country. If you put up all sorts of capital controls, you're gone.
Just with that, how do you think about credit cycles? The very first time I went to Dublin was actually at the peak of the GFC.
Ah.
And people were sleeping in sleeping bags on the Liffey River.
Yeah.
And I went to withdraw money at the ATM near Trinity College, actually. And Irish people were begging me for money. And I'm from Africa. So how, when you look back at that history, what's the difference between money and credit? And are we always going to have a credit cycle, no matter how sophisticated we become?
It's a great question, okay? So money and credit are two very different things. Money, as in the money you have in your pocket, you use to buy your groceries with, is money in the form of something physical. Credit is a bizarre thing. Credit is money in the form of a promise, okay? And once we get our heads around that, again, we put humanity in. I promise to give you something, right? How many promises have you broken, Duncan, in your life? Loads, right? We all do. It's human nature. Because promises are predicated on an impression of the future, which tends typically to be very rosy, right? And the one thing we know about the future is you cannot forecast it. We try to do it. People like you and I, you know, we try to make a good fist of it. We try to figure things out. But in fact, nobody knows what's going to happen in the next 10 minutes, let alone the next 10 years. So money in the form of a promise, therefore, requires a number of things for it to work. The first thing it requires is that your promises come true. None of us can actually ever suggest that. So what we do, I come back to this idea of the collective, we convince ourselves that everything is going to work out. So credit cycles are nothing more than human nature. And the thing about human nature is we tend to get giddy together, which is why we get excited, and we tend to get depressed together. Now, why is that? I think it's because humans are profoundly social. And because we're profoundly social, we infect each other with our enthusiasm and our optimism on the one hand and our pessimism on the other hand. That's all the credit cycle is. It's a reflection of enthusiasm for the future or pessimism for the future. And of course, coming back to the social animal, the reason that we get pessimistic is not that we conclude uniquely that the future is getting worse. It's because we get a vibe from others, okay? So if you think of two types of investors in the business, there's momentum investors and value investors, right? The vast majority of humans are momentum investors, right? FOMO is the greatest, one of the greatest, greatest propellants for investment is the fear of missing out. It's the great JP Morgan idea, which he said is a great quote. He said, "Nothing so undermines your financial judgment as the sight of your neighbor getting rich." Okay? So when the guy next door to you gets a Mercedes or a BMW or whatever, you're like, what's going on in his world? What's he doing that I'm not doing, right? The same thing happens. So on the way up, FOMO drives markets. On the way down, you know, it's not fear of missing out. It's fear of being there drives markets. You want to get rid of things, which is why it's an amazing thing in credit cycles. A week ago, there were millions of buyers for something. The next week, the buyers have all disappeared. Now, why is that? They're the same people. It's the same product. It's the same idea. It's because the psychology of the herd has changed and we go from one state of grace to another, from a state of grace to a state of profound pessimism. And that's what I think credit cycles are. They're nothing more than human nature. And money amplifies it because money is in some way like a referee. It's an arbiter of success, etc. And I think that's what you're seeing in the United States. You look at our friends, the Magnificent Seven, what's actually driving them is FOMO more than anything else. I mean, you've got to a strange situation in the States where seven stocks in the S&P 500 of 500 companies, seven stocks.
30%,
yeah. 30%, which means what has happened to the other 493 companies, right? So, I mean, that's a great example. And that gets us into booms and busts and all the stuff, Duncan, that makes the markets fascinating.
So one of the most important things to South African investors is China.
Yep.
Not only because of Naspers is our biggest share, Richemont, the miners. So we've spent years and years and years looking at China. It's complicated, hard to understand. You know, that debt-driven investment, they're not able to go back from investment to consumption.
Yes.
Certainly in my view. If Chairman Xi made you economic czar tomorrow and said, fix it on pain of death. What's your sort of reading on China now?
I think the way to read China is to look at, for example, a massive country like the United States at the latter part of the 19th, early part of the 20th century, where you see a broadly similar trajectory, where the country begins divided, poor, post a civil war, trying to get its act together, and gradually galvanizes this extraordinary two resources that the Americans had. One is the physical resources of the land and the continent, and the other was the extraordinary commercial resources of the people. China has broadly shown the world that it can do both. So I'll give you a good example. For example, the Americans are now slapping tariffs on everybody, and let's say making cars, right? The Americans make 3% of the world's automobiles. 3%. The Chinese make 36%. So the Americans will never catch up. So what I would say is that every single developed country goes through a manufacturing phase, and the Chinese are going through that. So you don't get rich without making things, right? Certain small countries like Ireland can get riches on services. There's only 5 million of us here, so it's not really important, right? That's the first thing. The second thing I would do if I were in Xi's position is that they're going through a period of debt deflation. So what do you do in debt deflation? I'll go back to economic history. You adopt exactly the same thing that the Americans did in the 1930s. So what did Roosevelt do? He decided, okay, gold standard, abandon that. So abandon all exchange rate targeting, first of all, the Chinese have to do. Number two, you have to print your own currency in enormous quantities to try and convince people to actually start to spend again, but more importantly, to avoid what the great economist Irvin Fisher talked about, which is the Chinese are looking to be in this position, a debt deflation spiral, where your previous investments, as you said, extreme overinvestment destroys the balance sheet. The balance sheet is destroyed. This causes people to hoard. The hoarding causes the economy to shrink. The shrinking economy causes the tax base to shrink. And you end up with massive, massive default problems. I think that what they do is they abandon any notion of exchange rate targeting. Now, what does that do? This upsets the Americans. I mean, we forget that one of the extraordinary global phenomena of the last 15 years has been the willingness of the Chinese to suppress American interest rates. By that, I mean to buy American fixed income assets when they know they're going to lose money on it. What that has done is it has led to the financialization of the United States in short order, because the real rate of interest has been too low for too long. And this has led to the bubbles in asset prices, the bubbles in financial markets. And it has also led indirectly to Trump, because people who owned assets have got very rich, and people who depended on wages for their income have got relatively poor. They're the sort of the left behinds, and they've created a whole new political narrative. So if I were the Chinese, I would first of all start selling American assets in response to, for example, American tariffs. The Americans have probably a net liability to the world of about $13 trillion. And by that, I want people to understand is that is what the rest of the world lend to the Americans so they can actually live the way they do. This is what pays for American Botox. This is what pays for all sorts of, is basically foreign money. So if I were the Chinese, I would risk right now not only a trade war, but a capital war with the Americans, which would put some manners on our friends, MAGA, our MAGA friends. Because the great thing about economics, Duncan, is it puts manners on people. Macroeconomics is a disciplinarian creature, and she is a very difficult, difficult master. The United States at the moment are behaving as if macroeconomics doesn't matter. If I were the Chinese, I would take a leaf out of the FDR book, and I would just go for it. And I think that would change things profoundly for them. But they are probably not thinking in cycles. You've studied them quite a bit. They're probably thinking in decades. They're thinking, you know, should we do what the Japanese did in the 1980s and is basically acquire market share in the United States in order to continue as an export growing economy? Maybe they'll do that. But if I were them, I would play the Americans at their own game. Because only by reflating can they actually create the background noise that will allow the party to remain in power.
You know, it's an extremely complicated subject. As my friend James Aiken says, monetary is not the problem. Fiscal is not the problem. Communism is a problem. But we'll leave that for later. Maybe just to finish off, David, last question. As someone who's part of the Eurozone for now, we'll see what happens with the border. What's your thinking on Europe longer term? It just seems like they're going backwards. Germany, France, Italy. Can the Eurozone hold together? Should it be together?
Good question. And again, I was a young economist when we were negotiating the Maastricht Treaty in Ireland in the central bank. So I was kind of involved tangentially at the very early negotiations of this. The first thing is probably the greatest counter-cyclical indicator is Davos, where I was made a young global leader many years ago. So I know that world quite well.
Sorry about that.
I know, exactly. It's I'm described by both the left wing and right wing in Ireland as a WEF shrill. I didn't realize you could actually annoy them both. But I think one of the greatest counter-cyclical indicators is what people at Davos say. So this morning, I'm just reading on my phone the latest screed coming out of Davos, which is that we have reached peak pessimism in Europe and enormous enthusiasm for the United States. I, as a betting man, am quite happy to bet when everybody is screaming pessimism and everybody is screaming optimism, I'm quite happy to take the contrary position, right? I think that what is happening in the European Union is very, very clear that the world has decided that Europe is a museum, okay? That we're a nice place to live and we've got nice food and nice beer and lovely old universities, but we don't make anything, okay? I wouldn't bet against the Europeans, number one. Number two, I think at the moment, there's probably peak effusiveness on the United States. I think it's all blue skies. So I think the chances of things going wrong in the States are much, much higher than things going wrong from here in Europe. On the Eurozone, I was reading last night the biography of Konrad Adenauer, who was the first post-war president or prime chancellor of the German Federal Republic. And what you realize reading about Adenauer and de Gaulle even, and all those characters from the 60s, 70s, 50s, 60s, 70s, is the enormous amount of political capital that has been invested in Europe in the project. And the project is the European Union for a variety of reasons. The euro has been a profoundly successful currency in the sense that it has been able to, A, function as money for, as you know, an entirely disparate bunch of nations, cultures, economies, societies, philosophies, and it's done extremely well. That's the first thing. It's a very, very robust currency. For a currency that was invented, what, 20 years ago, it's done extremely well. It's, by a country mile, the second most important currency in markets. It has kept things together. It has been the protection of many European countries. Now, will there always be a Greece? Will there always be an Ireland? You experience it? Yes, there will. If you have economic cycles that are discordant, are you going to get situations where an African man is being asked by Irish beggars for a couple of euros on the street? Yes, you will. Is there going to be a certain amount of fiscal indiscipline and consequently discipline? Yes, there will. But is there a realistic pathway to the breakup of the European Union heralded by a breakup of the euro? I really cannot see that. I think it's a much more messy and consequently anti-fragile, to use the expression of Nassim Taleb, project than people really... Like, the most fragile entity in Europe is Britain. I think that Britain will, in the course of this Labour government, will be bailed out by the IMF. I think Britain is a country that is experiencing a guilt crisis. I think there's going to be a run on sterling. I think if you have, for example, zero growth rate and 5% long-term interest rates and your debt-GDP ratio is 100, you and I know, Duncan, that that is a recipe for a debt deficit spiral. So what I would think is that Europe will amble along. Why? Because Europe has been running the current account surplus for many, many years. Now, that means that Europeans have more money on deposit than they care to spend. That's always a good position to be in. It means that your growth rate is always going to be slightly underwhelming, but it means that your actual permanent robustness is much more impressive. Countries that I worry about more in this new American world are countries that depend on the kindness of strangers to cover their day-to-day expenses. So they are countries that are running large current account deficits at a time when the Americans are quite happy to allow the dollar rise. And the markets are saying at the long end, you know what? The jury is out on whether the Americans do everything they want to do at this rate of inflation. We may well need a higher rate of interest to compensate for increasing inflationary risk, which we know in imagery is basically our bond vigilantes coming back into the game. So I think Europe, Duncan, has always been underestimated by the Anglo-Saxon press. There has been a weakness for those of us who read media sourced in London. There has always been a weakness in London for the final implosion of the euro, which will prove all the golf club revolutionaries of Surrey right. I don't see that happening at all. I think that in the region, the country that's probably most unstable at the moment is the UK. I see a current account crisis in the UK. I see an IMF bailout. I don't think people will lend to the UK at present rates of interest. That'll be followed by Greek-style austerity and probably by the end of the decade, a government run by a character called Nigel Farage. And I really think that that should not be something you bet against.
I mean, they're comparing it to 1976, which is the year I was born. But David, thanks very much. We really appreciate it. And I just want to say to everyone, I recommend reading the book and hopefully we see you in Franschhoek.
Great stuff, Duncan. It's been an absolute pleasure. I will see you in Franschhoek.
Thanks.
And then we'll see you on the pitch with a bit of rugby union between these two great teams very soon.
Cool. As long as you're buying the beer, David, that's fine.
No worries.
Thank you to David McWilliams for joining us today and sharing his insights. And, you know, we spoke a lot about the history of money and we basically did a tour of the world through the lens of money and credit. If you would like to get in touch, please send an email to info@alangray.co.za. Please subscribe to the podcast. I mean, you can do it on any of the platforms you normally listen to podcasts. Alan Gray is an authorized FSP. To view our terms and conditions, please visit alangray.co.za. Until next time, I'm Duncan Artis. The podcast was produced by Volume Podcasts.
Imagine if you could save time like you save money. A second here, a minute there. Type a little faster, walk a little faster. Or you could stop scrolling on the internet. Just think of all the hours you'll save. Now what if you could take all that time and invest it? Watch it grow. Until eventually, one day, you'd have so much time that you wouldn't know what to do with it all. But unfortunately, time doesn't work like that. It can't be stored or banked. And unlike money, you can't make it back. That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do whatever you want to do, even if it is scrolling on the internet. Alan Gray, long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized FSP.